You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. In your backyard. And worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumour.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes. What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes.
Yeah, minutes. It's not next year, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Have you ever pondered the idea of migrating from your existing operating system to the next with the promise of greener pastures? Has the thought of a few new features in your favourite software got the better of you? Or have you ever contemplated a complete change of platform? It's a big decision and often the cause of much anguish over many days. Fortunately, the upgrade of a simple single application isn't too daunting. But spare a thought for the application that radically changes the way it saves its files or the way it changes its look and feel. If the software designers have done their job correctly, the removal of the old and the addition of the new should be an uneventful experience. But it doesn't always go according to plan. What does that dialog box that pops up midway through the installation, after the previous removal process has completed, that states the installation could not be completed because of an unknown error? It's at this point in time that you run out of the room holding your head screaming obscenities and your neighbours see a side of you that they weren't previously aware of. You can certainly see why a lot of computer users subscribe to the if it ain't broke, don't fix it way of thinking. This is certainly the case for operating system upgrades, office productivity suites, and accountancy software. There's normally too much to lose if it all goes wrong, but is this becoming a thing of the past? There are some simple processes and ideas you can follow when performing the upgrade to change your life. And today the panelists will share some of their experiences when it comes to the mother of all upgrades. Also, we talked to Sarah Bond from Microsoft about the benefits of migrating to Office 2007. There are major changes to the way Microsoft Office looks and handles its files, which, to the ill-informed, could be the biggest reason not to migrate to the new Office system. But like everything, when you know how, it's easy, and there's nothing to worry about. Really.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Telstra's broadband meltdown leaves thousands offline. Adam Turner looks at journalism and blogs, where he deciphers the fine line between balance and object reporting to personal opinion in blogs. Lydia Davis, the Californian blog queen, also joins us on this matter. Cheap Wi-Fi, is it too slow? Coonan dials up the broadband hotline, and an Australian recently extradited to the US to face piracy charges receives a 4-year jail term. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making news in the IT world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Pentagon email hacked, Bush faces broadband slug, Opal bid waives a different standard, and Microsoft changes Vista Search. Welcome to Tech Talk News. The communications regulator has imposed its heaviest fine for breaches of the Spam Act, dishing out over $15,000 in penalties. The Australian Communications and Media Authority said Pitch Entertainment Group, which trades as Splash Mobile in Australia, was fined $11,000 for sending out over 1 million commercial text messages without a functional unsubscribe facility. The Spam Act of 2003 regulates unsolicited commercial electronic messaging in Australia. The fine is the largest imposed by the ACMA to date and has been levied with the imposition of stringent compliance reporting and staff education obligations. ACMA also fined IMP Mobile $4,400 for the same breach. A hacker has penetrated an unclassified Pentagon email system, prompting authorities to take as many as 1,500 accounts offline. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said elements of the Office of the Secretary of Defense unclassified email system were taken offline yesterday due to a detected penetration.
Between 1,000 and 1,500 users of the system were taken offline. On Wednesday, a congressional panel disclosed that hackers had also succeeded in penetrating computers at the Department of Homeland Security, the lead government agency in providing security against cyber attack. Country residents could be slugged with internet installation bills of up to $1,000 under the federal government's planned $1.9 billion broadband network. The cost would be borne by those residents likely to receive the slowest internet access speeds, thanks to the technology and frequencies that the Optus and Elders Opal consortium had selected to deliver wireless internet services. Gartner Mobile and Wireless Research Director Robin Simpson said Opal's decision to use 5.8 GHz and 3.4 GHz spectrum bands would require users to install small TV or satellite dish-like antennas on their homes to receive wireless signals. The consortium had also selected a combination of Spectrum and WiMAX wireless technology, the 802.16D standard, that was not in common use globally. An agreement between Australia's licensed WiMAX providers, Unwired and Austar, to use different broadband technology from that proposed by the federal government could throw the $2 billion regional broadband plan into chaos. Austar has signalled it may move to compete with the Optus Elders joint venture Opal, using its own WiMAX spectrum in regional areas, despite missing out on the massive government subsidy. The two companies between them spent close to $300 million on licensed spectrum at the height of the dot-com boom and 2 years ago undertook a spectrum swap. Unwired took spectrum in the 2.3 GHz and 3.5 GHz bands in metropolitan areas, and Austar took the same spectrum across the rest of the nation. WiMAX works across a number of wavelengths, but is subject to interference if it uses unlicensed spectrum in heavily populated areas. It is understood that a special agreement between Unwired and Austar insists the mobile WiMAX technology known as 802.16E be used. Microsoft has fended off Google's antitrust complaints by agreeing to make it easier for users to choose competitors' search engines. Microsoft's compromise with the US Justice Department, detailed in a report released last Tuesday, allows Windows Vista users to set a non-Microsoft program as the default search engine on hard drives. Microsoft will also add a link to that alternative program in the Windows Start menu, but will not change the way Vista Instant Search technology works. Recent concessions by Microsoft are part of a broader battle between the two companies. While Windows continues to dominate the desktop operating system market, Google's ability to make money from search advertising has left Microsoft scrambling to catch up. Google has also stepped into traditional Microsoft territory in the past year with a set of free, web-based programs for word processing, spreadsheets, and presentations. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Computers that control life support systems aboard the International Space Station have failed, and in the worst case scenario, could force all crew members to come home early.
You're a Firefox user, Graham.
I'm also a Firefox user. I've got Firefox on it as well.
Was there a discernible difference in the speed?
Well,
I'm going to go out on a limb here, do some serious speculation, which is what Tech Talk Radio is all about and stands for.
We had a staff offer at Telstra where you could get broadband on ADSL for about a quarter of the cost.
12 megabit is a reasonable sort of median figure for ADSL 2, ADSL 2 Plus.
They have to find, well, hopefully they have to find 11 transmitters, and they're set throughout the Crater Lakes in the Blue Lake.
Not a good spot to be in, is it?
No, well, no, it's not a bad spot to be in.
The decision on where we get that premises is determined by whether ADSL 2 is available there.
Sounds like organised chaos, Andrew. People driving everywhere. You're yelling at people saying, go straight ahead. And they're going, no, you can't go straight ahead. And
it was a T-intersection.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And it was a T intersection too. Good evening, Dr. Ron. Good evening, Graham Callaghan. Welcome, everybody, to Tech Talk Radio. For this week, I'm the croaky Andrew McComb, just the back end of one of those dreaded things that's been floating around the place. How are you, Dr. Ron?
I'm very well, thank you. You've got your sexy 0055 telephone voice on tonight.
I have indeed. It's been one of those, croaky weeks.
But you're coming out of the worst of it now, you said.
I am indeed. So what's news? Anything exciting?
It's been frantic this week.
Yeah? Built a media station lately? How's your Windows XP media, home media thing going?
It needs rebuilding. I've had it for over a year running there in the living room. I looked the other day and it's been up and running
for that long, so probably about time I reloaded it all and started again from scratch.
Adam's got some good tips for you on that, so stay tuned tonight.
And, I'm looking forward to hearing what Adam's got to say, a bit of controversy there.
Yes, there is. There's also a few other interesting things too, which we should touch base on, I guess, early on in the piece. Sarah Bond from Microsoft is going to have a chat to us later on this evening about Office 2007. Now, I bet you guys haven't been there. Have you been to Office 2007 yet? You loaded it up when it originally came out as a beta and nearly fell off your chair when you saw it, ribbon.
I did. I said, oh, let's turn my PC into a Mac. Holy smoke. And then I uninstalled it.
I just recently installed the trial version off the Microsoft website. I downloaded the trial to run it.
And?
Looks interesting.
It does look interesting, doesn't it?
I don't know where to find anything that I'm used to finding.
Did it load up all right for you?
I loaded up fine, yeah.
Oh, good.
It was just downloaded 50 or 60 odd meg and, yeah, just installed straight away, yeah.
How are your round buttons?
Yeah.
You're not a fan, are you? You're not sold on them, I can tell.
Well, not yet. Yeah, this is one of those things that maybe takes a bit to get used to.
It does. But anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that later on this evening, because we're going to talk... In fact, it was Sarah who put the idea into my mind. We should talk about upgrades from hell that we've all done, because we've all brazenly gone down that path of putting new software on our machines in the course of time. And we've learned along the way, haven't we, guys?
Yes.
So we're going to share some of our experiences with you, hopefully give you a little bit of an insight into that sort of stuff. And hopefully, yes, you won't go down the path that we went... And all ends up well at the end of your upgrade.
Speaking of not going down the path that we went down, what happened to the iTunes feed?
That's a very good question. What happened to the iTunes feed? I fell off the side of the planet, I think, on Tuesday. And in fact, well, you should mention that, says he's shuffling around here. We had emails.
We did. We had lots of emails. Sorry, everybody. You should have the last show now.
Yeah, I think you got on Saturday.
Yeah.
Oh, I've lost my lead. They're here somewhere.
We just want to
read them out too. Oh, here we go. Alan Lazarus said, gents, the recent podcast isn't linking from my iTunes. Can you fix it, please? I need my Australian accents on my iPod.
Yeah.
That was one. Yeah, there's another couple here. This is from Mark Snell. I thought there was something missing in my week. yes, show 25. I'm sorry, guys.
Alan and Mark either. We were inundated with messages, so I put a little note on the forum there to explain that we were having some problems.
But I think it's good. It was a test. I deliberately meant to do that because now we know that they miss us, Dr. Ryan. Isn't that a nice thing?
It was an indication that we were missed, and it's nice to be missed, but we're sorry we interrupted everybody's podcasting schedules. It's terrible. Then you get a week behind, and then before you know it, you've got all these podcasts banking up.
Look on the bright side of it. They get a double hit of us now. They'll get tonight's or today's show tomorrow, so they can listen to it in the evening or whenever it is that they choose to listen to the podcast.
To two in a row.
If I remember to put it on.
If we get this week's one right.
Dear. Well, while we're on the subject of letters, I've got some for those people who did listen to show 25 last week that did manage to get it. Susie sent us an email. She said, I was listening to you talk about the new bid assistant on eBay. It's very handy, and it actually allows you to add items to a list, then specify the price you would pay for each one. Now, just to refresh users, we were playing around on eBay. I won the auction, by the way. We were off air by the time the auction that I was bidding on.
Oh, good. And what was that for?
That was for a little GPS device, which I've now got, actually. So less than a week from Hong Kong from here on eBay. That's not bad, is it?
You did very well.
Not bad at all.
Yes. And I found them here. They're about $90 Australian, but I bought mine for $42 on eBay.
Very good. We all had our little GPS devices out last week playing.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I didn't bring it in for show and tell. That's radio, you know. Susie sent us this email. You don't have to put all the items... sorry, let me start again. You don't have to put the same price for all the items. That way, you just keep going until you actually win the bid, which is really the way I won my little GPS thing last week. Most of them were going for about $50, so I thought, let's throw it in at $42, and I was running on a couple of auctions, and I won one, so... That was the main thing. She also says she loves the podcast. I don't get to listen to the live stream, but I always download the full show on Tuesdays when we put it up there. So, thank you, Susie. And there was another one. Here we go. This one was from... And it's really good when you guys send us emails like this. It actually makes it feel like it's all worthwhile coming in here and having a chat and talking about technology the way we do. This one's from Mark. Hi, guys. Love the show. I'm a long-time listener, and I want you guys to know that you are the only Australian IT podcast I listen to. Please don't change your Australian-based IT format and become more international. There's plenty of international IT podcasts out there. you guys are the best Australians. I like reading these sort of ones. These are good. It makes everyone feel good, doesn't it? Then he adds, also, I'm an ex-Telstra employee, so please keep sticking it into them. We don't stick it into them. We just report the facts. That's what it's all about.
Only usually. When they really deserve it. Thanks for the feedback, Mark, and thanks, Lucy, as well.
Phil was in the news today, too. Have you got anything you want to add, Frapper stuff, while we're
doing this? Yeah, I want to say a forum hello to a new forum user, Tappy.
Tappy, g'day Tappy.
Who's already actively posting and helping people out, which is great to see.
Where's Tappy from?
And congrats to GD, who finally got his image to appear.
I had that as a note here, Graham. Well done, GD, who's finally... We can now see the technical cocky on the forum.
Yes.
If you want.
Oh, he had problems with his avatar, did he?
He had problems with his cocky, yeah.
But it's all good now.
Cocky found his cracker.
Yes, he did, and you can see it if you go to forum.tiktokradio.com.au.
Indeed.
And it's nice to know there's people out there listening.
It's good. It's good. Thank you. And whilst we're doing cheerio, this is the longest opening to the show we've done in a long time.
It's good though. We'll be up for the closer shortly. That's all right.
A big hello to our new Western Australian listeners listening to us in Perth and the surrounding internet areas of WA on Queer FM.
Welcome to the new listeners. That's tremendous news.
Yeah, so Russell invited us on his show and we're there. And I think... you can hear us 8 o'clock in the evening on a Friday night, Western Australian time. So if you miss us, if you're listening to us live or you can't hear the stream or whatever happens and you go, oh my goodness, I can't get to the download, you can hear it streaming on the Queer FM website out of Perth in Western Australia. So hello out there to all of our Western Australian listeners. All right. That's it for letters. Nothing else in the letters department over there, Dr. Ron? We're done?
All done, all silent.
Okay, how about this chappy that got extradited to the United States for $6 million worth of... no, it was more than that.
Of software
the
piracy.
The video piracy, yeah. The Central Coast man who headed Drink or Die Underground Internet Piracy Group has been sentenced to 51 months prison for copyright infringement charges. The US Department of Justice said the 44-year-old British national who had been living in Bateau Bay in Australia was amongst the first people to be extradited to the United States for intellectual property offences. This is the start of it, isn't it? This is a bit of a, hey guys, if you do this and you get caught and you're on the wrong side of the extradition laws, you're going to meet and suffer and pay the price, even if you live in a funny small place called Bateau Bay in the central coast of New South Wales.
Well, that's right. And this guy wasn't running a multi-million dollar business profiting off the piracy. As far as I can gather, he was giving the stuff away.
Was he? Okay, so it wasn't as if he was making money out of it.
That was a bit I read, so yeah.
So it was illegal software distribution rather than actually running a business.
So those people that put links up and stuff, and there's a lot of it out there. You don't have to be, you know, you can easily find it. If you know what you're looking for, you can find it very easily.
Oh, he's been shipped offshore, has he, to the United States?
Yep. Yes, he was extradited.
And they've locked him up and thrown away the key.
For 51 months, apparently.
Well, it's hardly throwing away the key, but...
But 51 months, what's that, four and a bit years? You'll be out of year.
Put a dent in your social life, that's for sure.
Think about what you'd have to do in Australia to get locked up for 51 months.
Yes, well...
But yeah, this isn't, doesn't really bother
thinking about, really, talking about the legal system, we're here to talk about technology. So, there we go. Interesting.
So, yes, 51 months jail for people doing naughty things with other people's movies. And I think this is a bit of an exhibition case, too, so... Coonan dials up broadband. Now, how's this broadband stuff? It's like we've gone out of the, you know, fire into the frying pan, I think, or whatever it is that the saying is. Like, last week we had the announcement of the Wi-Fi technology, the Optus, and as you said in the news there, Graham, the Optus and Elders proposal. Yep. Now we've got all this hoo-ha-ha about the Wi-Fi not being able to cut the mustard and get all that far down the track, and because we've got 5 gig and 3 gig or something. So.
And there's two different types of WiMAX involved, two different slightly different standards, yeah.
I never knew there was two different types of... I thought WiMAX was WiMAX.
No, it all turns out they're not quite. I haven't quite fathomed what the technical difference is, but there's a slight difference between the version that the Austar and that mob are using, and the other version that Optus and Elders and the government are using.
Okay,
is it similar, Graham, to Wi-Fi where you have different speeds and different encryption types?
I haven't figured that out yet, but all I know is that one's got a D on the end and one's got an E on the end. So that's
well, that makes all the difference, doesn't it? When you buy the box, you've got to make sure it's got a D or an E on the end.
And the other thing that it might complicate is the availability of equipment to connect to it. So
well, the thing that bothers me is that Wi-Fi, or WiMAX in this case, is supposed to be easy. Yeah. It's turn your laptop on, like we do here, you know, just open it up, turn it on, and it works. You don't need any external antennas or anything like that. Now you need a degree in, you know, antennology, I guess, for want of a better term, to go out there and put your bit of thing on the roof and point it in the right direction. So I think it's a bit of a big ask for a lot of mums and dads out there if they just want their wireless broadband in the country. Anyway, I could be wrong.
I don't know. I think that it will there'll have to be professional installation of this sort of stuff. If you're putting WiMAX in lieu of a fibre or ADSL or one of those sorts of technologies.
Yeah, for a long-haul link.
That's right, Graham. Yeah. It'll have to be professionally installed. And as Mark, I think, was commenting last week, you will have to put up poles in the sky, you'll have to put up antennas, and you will have to run cables and do some fairly advanced installation work.
It's not supposed to be this hard, is it?
Well, as opposed to what you would do in the metropolitan area, we just plug in a modem. And it does have to be that hard, unfortunately, because of the technology involved. And as a one-off, and the distances involved, Graham, as a one-off, you do have to have an installation done. But once you've paid the money and the installation's there, you should be right. Yeah.
Well, Senator Coonan this week announced a dial-up broadband hotline. Did you hear about this? Just in case you want to ask questions. I don't know, what would you bring? Anyway, we'll find out. The hotline will be accompanied by a website, broadbandnow.gov.au, offering a broadband service locator. Haven't we got those already?
Well, we do.
What's broadband choice and all them?
Why would you trust a government-funded recommendation
you are
site
such a
over
cynic.
Well, but it's an obvious question to ask. The first thing that comes to mind, we've got independent non-profit organisations that are running broadband location type services on the web. Why would the government then go out of its way to put one up? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Mm.
And I don't know why someone would use that over an independent one.
Well, as of July the 1st, this is when it's going to kick in, but broadband providers are questioning whether people would approach the government for a broadband recommendation.
There you go.
Just as you said, Dr. Ron. They say that there are already a number of similar broadband... Oh, I can throw this press release away. Now, you've already covered most of that.
I may have written that, actually. No, it sounded like what I was saying, didn't it?
The Communications Minister announced that Broadband Now today, as part of close to $1 billion initiative to build a new broadband network for rural and regional Australia. And if we're a week down after the announcement, we've already got such a ruckus going on out there and a brouhaha.
We haven't heard this much broadband news come out of the Senator's office for years, have we? But it's just in the last few months
I can tell you, the inbox is thick and fast.
Why do you think that is?
Junk mail from her? Oh, yeah. November, boys.
Next.
Just put that in your diary. Next. Telstra. Let's go from one fire to the other. Telstra. GD sent me an email, but hey, GD, this is good. Thanks. Keep them coming. But Telstra restores services after broadband meltdown. Thousands of Australians lost their internet connections for hours on a couple of nights back following a core broadband network outage that battered all major internet service providers. I didn't feel it, did you?
I didn't notice it, but this is the issue. Even though it's Telstra, it's not just going to affect Telstra subscribers, it's also going to affect other ISPs that use Telstra for backhaul and connection to the internet as well.
Yeah. The outage stemmed from a server fault. Funny, that's where they all start, isn't it?
Yes.
In Telstra's network and affected Big Pond, Optus, Internode, Exatel, Westnet and other ISPs. Some users lost their internet connectivity completely, while others reported to be unable to access international sites and extremely sluggish access to local sites. Well, yeah, extremely sluggish. I think there's a lot of that going around at the moment. So it just goes to show, it's a bit like on the freeway, isn't it? When someone breaks down in front of you, everyone comes to a halt.
That's exactly it.
So anyway. All right, the ACMA had a bit of a go at some spammers too during the course of the week.
Oh, good.
Just because we're in the mode of prosecuting people doing nasty things on the internet, ACMA got involved with the gig as well. The communications regulator has imposed its heaviest fines for breaches of the Spam Act, dishing out over $15,000 in penalties. The Australian Communications and Media Authority said Pitch Entertainment Group, now I think you touched on this in the news, didn't you?
It was in the news,
Graham,
yeah.
And Splash Mobile fined $11,000 for sending out $1 million of commercial text messages, wait for it, without a functional unsubscribe facility. Now that's yes, being a legitimate email marketer, as we do, because we do lots of email marketing, it is so imperative that you follow
and
comply.
Who's we, TechTalk, or your business?
No, our business.
Yeah, yeah.
We do a lot of stuff for a lot of private organisations. We run a facility which is called Chicken Mail, would you believe?
Okay.
And we do all that sort of stuff, and it is 100% compliant with the Spam Act. And it's so important because...
Well, we have to make sure on TechTalk Radio as well, when we send out weekly updates of what's on and things like that, we have to have a functioning unsubscribe link as well, in case
you do?
People don't want to receive the messages anymore.
One of the things about unsubscribe links is that a lot of people subscribe to a news list using some surreptitious email address, which they genuinely have, like you have, like the next person has, you know, plenty of working email addresses. Pick a domain and pick an email address.
You create one, don't you, whenever you sign up
exactly.
for something.
Now, I don't know. I'm speaking for myself here. I don't have a POP account for each one of those. It forwards it into my general collection account, and then I spam filter it and do what I need to do. And when you come to unsubscribe to one of these email addresses, you think, oh my goodness, which email address does this have to come from? Because if you don't unsubscribe, normally, from the email address that you've got, it says, no, that's not you. So, tricky stuff. But there's some new clever software out these days too, which you can actually go and type your email address in. It knows who you are, regardless of where you are. Like, browser-dependent sort of unsubscribes can work as well, so.
It's a big issue. We had Bruce Matthews from the Australian Communications and Media Authority on the show towards the end of last year, I think. We should invite him to come back on and give us an update as to how their Spam Matters program is working. But it sounds like they are going ahead in leaps and bounds if they're prosecuting more people, because it's just rampant, isn't it?
It's a terrific initiative, I think. It's got a... And, like, even the capture software that I run on some of my forms, they're getting around that. As I was saying tonight to someone, you know, the little sort of graphic picture you put down before you submit a form to prove that you're human, they can get around some of these things these days. It's driving
some of them
bonkers.
Surprisingly easily, too.
Yeah, yeah. And you just wonder what for. What could they possibly have that they would want? All right, listening to Tech Talk Radio, Dr. Ron Graham Callaghan and Andrew McComb. We're going to be talking blogs and journalism after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Righto, boys, who blogs here? We all sort of do a little bit of blogging from time to time. I know that, Dr. Ron, you have the drron.com.au blog happening there, the WordPress blog, which you've loaded up on your machine.
I was updating my blog today. I've been doing a little bit tinkering here and there, and it's a lot of fun. It can actually take up a lot of time. And
we all know that Graham over here, he runs the Tech Talk Radio news group, really well. The forums, yeah.
So yeah, I don't blog as such, yeah, no. But the forums are a bit along the same lines, I suppose.
Yeah. The social networking
exactly.
site, aren't they? Yeah.
Now, Dr. Ron, what goes in your blog? It's more a personal opinionated thing, isn't it? More so than a news.
It's what I'm doing personally, what I'm doing with work and with reviews of technology, opinions on technology and things like that. Like at the moment, I think the article I was updating today was on my new mobile phone, and the comment I put there was, don't throw away your MP3 player just yet, even though it's just got Walkman stamped all over it. But
oh yeah, because you bought a new one. You're blogging about your new...
Exactly, and I've been updating it as I'm discovering new features and new bugs and problems with it, so it is very much an opinion piece.
Yeah. Now, do you think that... we're going to hear a few pieces very shortly. Adam Turner, he's going to be talking about all this sort of stuff and sort of when does blogging become journalism and when does journalism become blogging and should everyone be... Now, are you...
Well, people are blurring that line, aren't they?
And this is the issue that we're talking about at the moment. In all right across the world is if someone writes a personal opinion about something, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a journalistic piece. You're not writing a review or something like that. It's just your personal opinion. Like I can say, you know, company X provided really dodgy, you know, facilities, or company Y were fantastic, or whatever it is like that. That's a personal opinion. It's like this show in a lot of respects, you know, and we colour our show accordingly, don't we? We have personal opinions, which is really what the panel's all about, and when we do our personal opinions, it's taken with that in mind. I think, hopefully, that's how we deliver it. And when we do news, like when Graham read the news this evening, it's a little bit more formal, and I think people are used to that format, so they know what to expect.
Yeah, I can see how product reviews could come very close to blurring with personal opinion, because you're reviewing something and you're giving an opinion on how it works and what your expectations are versus how it's actually performing. So you have to be careful if you're wanting to stay objective, just to stick to the facts as to what it does and doesn't do.
And I think it does also depend... not just on what type of piece it is, but some blogs are more newsy and some blogs are more opiniony than others. And even within the same blog, some entries might be more opiniony and some some entries might be more newsy than others.
I've just asked Google to define the word blog, and it's there's obviously a few have come up. I'll just choose one here at random. A blog is basically a journal that is available on the web. The activity of updating a blog is called blogging, and someone who keeps a blog is a blogger. Blogs are typically updated daily using software that allows people with little or no technical background to update and maintain the blog. So there you go. That's what a blog is. It's just it's like a public diary, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's the original intent. Yeah, web log. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look now, where a lot of these media organisations are trying to sort of, you know, get the edge, they're actually starting to mix blogs with news.
And that's,
and that's where things are going awfully wrong. Now, Lyd's going to have a chat to us very shortly, and I know one of the things that she said when I was talking to her is that there is the Google now knows the difference between a blog and news, and it should be kept separate. Whereas when you come to publishing, some organisations do tend to actually mix the two together, and that's where the problems
are. Well, I've got a comment to make on that comment, but we'd better do it after we hear from.
Oh, okay. Is that the cue, is it?
Opportunity to respond.
Ooh.
Oh, sorry.
All right. Well, first we're going to have a listen to Adam, his view from the couch this week, all about blogging and the media, or as in journalism, I guess.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Blogging is one of the most interesting things to happen to the concept of journalism in recent years. Now every man and his abo can voice their opinions to the world, but are all opinions equal? There's an ongoing debate over whether bloggers should be considered journalists, but less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog? As well as writing for newspapers and magazines, I also write for several websites, including itwire.com.au. ITWire is primarily a technology news site, but each contributing journalist also has his own blog on the site. Our blog entries appear on the front page of the site, mixed in with the news items. Google doesn't distinguish between news and blogs on the site, so our blog posts often end up on the front page of Google News' technology section. ITWire isn't alone here. Other blogs also appear in Google News. Admittedly, it does seem a bit arrogant for someone to consider their opinion to be newsworthy, but it's not much different to the idea of an opinion column in a newspaper. Anyway, bloggers seem to want the best of both worlds. They want to be treated as journalists, but they don't always want to abide by the general journalistic code of conduct, which includes concepts such as presenting both sides of the argument and offering the people and companies that you write about an opportunity to respond. One reason why you don't usually see this in a blog is because a blog entry is generally considered one person's opinion on one subject. Everyone is entitled to an opinion, and if they're not happy about something, a blog offers a perfect outlet to vent their spleen. The other main reason why you don't see blogs going to such lengths is because many bloggers would not have the time or the context to chase up comment from every person or company they had an opinion on. One thing I've noticed since I started writing for ITWire is that many readers don't seem to distinguish between a blog entry and a news item, which is understandable considering ITWire lists them all together and the blog label at the top of the blog pages is easy to miss. This can cause trouble when some people expect your blog post to abide by the rules of journalism. I created an uproar recently in exactly such circumstances. I'm writing a large story for a technology magazine on building media center PCs. Basically computers that connect to your television to play TV, movies, music and photos. It can be very tricky to get a media center to run smoothly, especially when you build them on Vista while they're still working out the bugs. So I turned to a website called xpmediacenter.com.au for some help. The site runs a forum where media center users exchange advice and it's been a great help. Anyway, I started off building a media center using an Nvidia graphics card, only to discover that Nvidia software doesn't offer some of the most important media center related features if you're running Vista. If I'd bought this card rather than borrowed it, I would have been extremely unhappy at this point. I decided to express my opinion on my ITWire blog, which is called Seeking Nerdvana. The blog post was entitled Nvidia Abandons Vista Media Center Users, and it detailed my grievances with Nvidia. I also pointed out that cards from Nvidia's rival ATI do offer these features. Anyway, the post was picked up by Google News, which brought it to the attention of the people who run the xpmediacenter.com.au site, who in turn posted a link to it on the front of their site. This kicked off a huge debate on the site, which is still raging a week later. You'll still find a link on the front page of xpmediacenter.com.au to the argument if you want to see what was said. A lot of interesting points were raised, issues that journalists will have to come to terms with over the coming years. Although most people seem to agree with me that NVIDIA wasn't supporting Vista Media Center users, their concerns were about the way my opinion was presented. It didn't fit their idea of unbiased journalism, because I hadn't asked NVIDIA to comment, and I hadn't listed the shortcomings of the ATI graphics cards. Most people said that if it had been more clearly labelled as a blog, they wouldn't have cared, although some felt it was a conflict of interest for a journalist to write news and blogs for the same site. Comments from XP Media Center users included, Adam doesn't seem to be interested in presenting all the relevant facts, just venting his frustrations. This is gutter journalism and an unbalanced article. Article is the key word here. Was this an article? What is an article? I draw a big line between the opinion articles I write for blogs and the news or feature articles I write elsewhere. They are different things serving different purposes. What I wrote in Seeking Nirvana was my opinion, but it was still based on facts, and it's something people building media centres need to be aware of. Had I written the item as a news article for ITY or any other publication, I would have taken a more balanced approach and offered NVIDIA the chance to comment. To me, it was obviously not a news piece because it was so clearly my opinion. I even referred to myself in the first person, something one doesn't do in a news item. Still, to the general public, the line between blogs and news is obviously blurring and they can't always distinguish between them. So what do you think? Do blogs have a place in news? Are blogs by definition biased? Are journalists allowed to have opinions and should they express them? These are the questions that will shape the future of news in the online age.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And we do value our independence, and that was Adam talking about blogs and things like that. We just logged on to the site whilst that was playing on air to xpmediacentre.com.au. And Adam's still there at number two, looking at 80 replies and 2,500 views. That's not bad for a week. Yes, but what were you going to say before, Graham? You had something you were going to make a mention of there.
Well, just the point that Adam refers to, the fact that IT Wire, the website that he writes both news and blogs for, they mix up on the front page the news items with the blog items.
And that's why Google gets confused.
And unless you're paying attention and look at the top, then you're not, you know, you might not realise that what you're looking at is an opinion piece and not a news item.
Yeah, and the two are very different.
And the two are very different. And Google, as you say, gets confused by that, despite the fact that they do try to separate news and blogs into separate search queries.
I think, so, knowing Adam, that the whether he's writing a news item or he's writing something for his blog, he's going to be professional and he's going to be factual, regardless of what
he's actually doing. Well, that's a journalistic background, isn't it?
Well, exactly, but the issue is, though, he's going to use a different style of writing with his blog, and, yeah, I agree with Graham. Looking at a printout of the article in question, it has got the word blog in very small letters at the top, and I can understand how people could be confused, and this is an issue, obviously, that IT Wire needs to address, but he raises a very valid question. Should journalists provide opinion pieces?
All right. Now, I had a chat to Lydia Davis, our US correspondent. She writes blogs and things like that in Silicon Valley. And also, she's she knows the goings-on of the Google giant over there. So who else better to have a chat to about the scenario but Lydia Davis? Californian's blog queen joins us on Tech Talk Radio now to deal with what Adam has just been talking about, that is the difference or the fine line between journalism and writing stories and blogging, which is generally a personal experience. Hello, Lydia, what do you make of all this?
Well, I love Adam's work most of the time, you know that. So I generally agree with a lot of what he says, but I've got a couple of problems with what he said just now, because I'm hearing bad, bad internet, really. That's what I hear.
Why bad? Why is it bad? Why is the internet to blame here?
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels that way. It feels like a lot of journalists are pushing it that way, saying, there's no other reason that this is the case but technology. So can I just go and say that, you know, I agree with Adam, because one of the things that he said was that Google mixes news with blogs, and I disagree with that. I agree that people don't know the difference between blogs and news. So, you know, if you have a look at what happened with Adam's post on Nirvana. He's researching this story, he finds a problem, he wants to share it, he blogs it, and I mean, that's what the blogosphere is for.
Well, blogs are about passion, aren't they? Like, Adam was passionate about what he did with his video card, and he thought he might write something about it, but it was misconstrued. That's how I read it. Is that how you read it?
No. He wrote a blog. He did the right thing. This is not in any way, shape, or form his fault, what's happened. What he's done the right thing. He's gone out there and said, hey, this is really crap, and I want to tell you about it, and I think I should tell you about it, because if you're about to try it, don't waste your money buying this card, because it doesn't work quite well quite yet. What's happened, where it's gone wrong, is the way it was published. Now, I personally don't think Adam has any control over what they publish, how they publish, what they do, and I don't know that much about ICWire, and I'm not in Australia to look at it daily, and I don't. But I did have a little bit of a look there today, and I just thought it was a bit tricky. Why did they put Adam's post, which was a blog on Nerdvana, why did they put that under breaking news? Because it's not news.
It's a blog. It's someone's personal opinion, and say, so are we going to see more of this?
Yes. You know, I looked at their site, and what they do is they let you submit a press release. Now, I looked at one, and like I said, I didn't look at everything. I didn't have the time, but I did look at one which was, you know, submitted by a company called Quantum Corp. Now, they've obviously paid to submit their press release. Now, that press release is now regurgitated on ICY's People page. So on the People page, they've got this little blurb about what this press release was, and I'm thinking, you know, they're just, it seems to be, the whole site seems to be optimised for search, but it's not optimised for people. And that worries me because, you know, a lot of people are doing this, particularly with mainstream. They don't know what to do with their websites because they're not used to technology. So they know publishing, they know, you know, journalism, they know what they know, but they're just doing it a little bit wrong as far as I'm concerned. So, which brings me to another comment of Adam's, and I really hope Adam doesn't hate me after all this, but he said bloggers want the best of both worlds, and they want to be treated as journalists, but they don't always adhere to the code of conduct. And I disagree. I don't think bloggers want to be treated as journalists at all. You know, I think bloggers are really sick of listening to the stuff that's been put out there as news, you know, because a lot of it's not news anymore. And you know what I'm talking about. You've got, you know, Current Affair, you've got Today Tonight, you've got all those. You know, and a lot of that stuff is being presented as news, and now it's just been, I suppose, changing form and being presented on the internet. And have you heard of Rathergate?
No, I haven't. Tell me about it.
Dan Rather, a guy at CBS.
He's a news anchor man, isn't he?
Was at CBS. He was doing a story for 60 Minutes where he basically questioned President Bush's military background. And he based on these documents. As it turned out, the documents were forgeries. They weren't right. And it was bloggers that actually found this out. Now, Dan spent 2 weeks saying, you know, rah, 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 you know, defending everything that he did and what he said. And in the end, he retired a little bit earlier than was expected. But, I mean, what bloggers are saying is, hey, this is just not good enough. You know, if you want to say it's news, make sure it's news and treat it that way. You know, make sure you've got the facts, write a balanced story, get your sources, edit, you know, and then write the thing. And this is not new. This sort of idea has been around for a while. Do you remember Being Digital? It's a book. And I can't remember the guy's name who wrote it. But basically, he said the audience of the future is going to change the way it gets its news because of technology. And he's saying, at that point in 1995 or 96, he was calling it the Daily Me, where the audience decides on what it reads. You know, and this is what's happening now. You know, we've got, 87 million blogs being logged by Technorati, something like that. You know, and as far as I'm concerned, bloggers fall into five categories. Now, you've got to love this. You've got the raffings. They're the people that go out there and whinge and point fingers.
The stirrers.
You know, life is... Yeah, well, everything sucks, you know, basically, and we want to share that.
Oh, the negative look of life.
Yeah. Then you've got the Cedrics. You know, they know everything about everything. Not everything about everything. They know everything about one topic, and they keep telling you, and they tell you everything about this topic until you're dozing. You know, then you've got the professors that they actually know what they're talking about, and they know a subject very well, and they offer really great advice and information to others who have the same passion. You've got the citizen journalists who have no formal training, but really, they're in a position to report stuff because they're where the news is breaking, you know, whether it's Iraq or, you know, Serbia, whatever the case may be. They can report because they're there and watching it. You know, and the last people that really in there are journalists who actually have skills in writing and journalism. And I honestly think there's a place for all of them, and I really don't think bloggers want to be known as journalists. But,
so do you think journalists should blog? Is that what it comes down to? Maybe
absolutely.
Journalists...
Absolutely.
They shouldn't blog,
they
or they should blog?
Absolutely. They absolutely should. they absolutely should be blogging because they know how to do it. I mean, look at Adam's story, for God's sake. You know, he wrote the perfect title, really, and he knows how to do that because it's part of his training, because he knows, you know, you've got to hook the audience, you know, and that's not a nasty thing. It's something that you need to do. So, I don't know, I look at it and I think, you know, the good journal, oh, I suppose maybe the smarter journalists have worked it out, sorry, and I think he's one of them because look at the other blogs he's writing. You know, come on. He's putting stuff out there, and he knows that he should because he knows how to write. He loves writing, and he's doing it.
And he's passionate about what he writes about, too. Obviously, why would you do it?
Absolutely. But then there's some journalists that are having problems with this. Now, look at how journalists are taught. You know, they're basically saying, you know, keep your sources close, you know, because they want to break the story. You know, they're the gatekeepers of information. And so I suppose they don't like to let other people know what they know until they write about it, and that way they get the, you know, they get the byline. There was a guy a couple of years ago who wrote a series of essays called Fixing Journalism. And the only line I remember out of the whole thing is something like, you know, one of the largest newspapers in America has no regularly updated searchable list of valuable contacts. And now, the paper's the Washington Post, and this was 2 years ago, and they don't share their sources, you know, and it's all about, you know, we've got to keep it private. And they do, because that's sort of, you know, built into them or shoved into them that, you know, you want to break the story. It's a thing that they've just got to get over and start sharing stuff like that. The other thing is, last year I took a class where we had a guest speaker called Stephen Ross, who just completed a study which was called The Web Made Me Do It and Other Fables of the Internet Age and Journalism.
What a great title, The Web Made Me Do It. That's classic.
I know. But one of the things he found was that 50% of journalists use blogs, and 70% of those that use them for work-related stuff, like finding stories, like story ideas, finding, you know, or research or reference, finding sources to interview. But only 1% considered web blogs to be credible. So that's interesting, don't you think? 1%.
Yeah, I think that's probably changed a little bit too, especially if, it's the professors, that middle group you mentioned earlier, if it's the professors writing the stories, I would treat that as being credible.
Absolutely, and this is why, you know, journalists are using these sites.
But even still, you look at what happened with Adam. He wrote a factual piece about a bit of technology that didn't work for him from what we can see as being a bit of an effort to warn others of the perils that are in front of them. If they're going down this same path, it was not supposed to be turned around and used the way it was.
No, and this is exactly what I'm saying. It's not him. At the end of the day, who's at fault is the publishers. It's got nothing to do with Adam because, you know, he's doing the best he can. He's saying, hey, this is my opinion, and I believe in the web, and I'm going to put out my opinion.
And in a lot of respects, Adam would have fallen into the professor role in this instance because he knew what he was doing. He was setting up his system at home.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, you know, one of the things that mainstream media are doing, and I think here in America it doesn't seem to be as big a thing now. It was a couple of years ago where it seemed that they're sort of moving in the right direction. I think Australia, as much as I love Australia and as much as I really believe, you know, Australia has so much over America in lots of ways, they're just, with sort of blogging and Web 2 and Semantic Web, they're just a little bit behind. I mean, even though journalists are willing to turn to the public for opinion, like Adam, he's actually asking all these questions of the public in his story a few minutes ago, but the publishers are not, and they're afraid that it's going to undermine their, you know, their authority. So they go, okay, well, let's just try it our way, and it's not working for them, and this is the problem. So I suppose they're all trying to do it. The publisher's trying to do what they know to do, you know, and they do things like they have pop-ups and pop-unders and for advertising because they know advertising works, but it's not going to work in this way. They need to get rid of this crap, and they've got better options. I look at, you know, Wall Street Journal, which just changed the way it presents its newspaper, it changed the way it presents its all its online stuff. That was in January earlier this year. And basically, the publisher said, we're the first newspaper that's going to truly reflect how people get their news and information in this always-on 24/7 information world. And it is. It's always on. And they're doing it. They're sharing blogs. They're sharing news. But they're separating it. You can go to the Wall Street Journal, and you know, if you search in Google for Wall Street Journal news, you'll get news. If you search for Wall Street Journal blogs, you'll get blogs. And that's the good thing. So they've worked it out, and they're doing the best they can. And I really think they're going to leave. But other companies need to do it. Other publishers need to do it. They need to start saying, okay, we can use this to our advantage. Have you ever heard of a company called Sphere?
No.
Sphere's a company here. It's a startup in San Fran. It's a really great concept. What they're trying to do is they're trying to marry blogs with mainstream media. What happens is you have this widget. You probably see it if you go to the New York Times or Time magazine or Wall Street Journal, you go to the better places, and you will find this widget where you click on fear, and what it does is it pops up this little window that says, these are related posts from mainstream media sites, these are related posts from blogs. So you can see, are you reading a blog or a news site?
Clearly separating the two things.
Absolutely. But married. So what they're doing is they're saying, we're passionate about news, whether it's from a blogger or from a news source, but we're going to show you that, you know, you have the two. You have the two to look at. You don't have to look at one or the other. I just think what happened with Adam was just typical of what would happen when papers and mainstream media aren't really getting it right. They still need to learn.
Obviously, IT Wire, they haven't been around for all that long from what I can understand, maybe a year if they're lucky, or maybe 2 years, I don't know. But at the end of the day, they're trying to get to, they want to be noticed, and they're pulling in everything they can so they can be noticed.
They have. But do you know the other thing they offer there, Andrew, which really upset me, is what they offer is a link exchange. And they do it so subtly, I suppose. They say, we will offer a link exchange with related content sites. Yeah, I mean, what a load of rubbish. Just by saying we're going to offer this to related sites doesn't mean anything. They're a link exchange place. They're going to give you a link if you give them a link. They want a link. The problem is they're not realizing, from a search engine optimization point of view, Google hates that. They don't want two-way links anymore. They've realized that people are doing this, so they're getting rid of it. Anyone that has a two-way link, they're going down in Google's eyes. So it just upset me as soon as I saw it. I thought, you know, this is what they're doing. They're just trying to optimize their site. And they're doing it, and this is what kills me. I'm really sorry, because the other thing I didn't mention before was press releases. Journalists sometimes have to write them, okay? I've had to write some. And I sometimes cringe when I write the stuff I write. Why am I writing this stuff that's really not newsworthy in any way, shape, or form, but you've got to do it because you're being paid to write a release, and you do your best to make it newsworthy, and at the end of the day, they don't want newsworthy, they want it to sell, and I'm not a marketer, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be a marketer, I can write, I can research, but I'm not a great marketer, I love the internet, you know, and at the end of the day, I look at that and I think, wow, it's such a shame that it can get so, I don't know, ripped apart, writing can be so ripped apart, and I've got to say, good on Adam, because he's teaching people how to do it.
While listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Well, passion aplenty in the studio here this evening. That was Lydia Davis, our US correspondent there in Palo Alto, who blogs on a regular basis. Now, she's firmly of the opinion that that Google does separate blogs and news. She's going off to see Adam Lasnik at Google and Googleplex down there in Mountain View and find out exactly what they do. That's her mission for the week. In the meanwhile, Adam was very clear in letting us know that from his experience, he says that Google does mix news and blogs. He runs Hydropinion, if that's how you pronounce it, Hydropinion, with four other freelancers, and the site is listed on Google News, even though he made it perfectly clear that the site is blogs only. So there's a bit of discrepancy there. We're not quite sure exactly how it's all coming together. Maybe it could be geographically based. Maybe it's different in the states than it is here, because we do know that Google does look at your IP address for your location and dishes you up its responses accordingly.
It was interesting that Lyd said that link exchanges were bad.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too.
Because I thought one of the many things that you do in search engine optimization to make your site friendly and attractive to search engines is that one of
share
the
links.
Well, you do. One of the techniques, Andrew, is to share links with somebody who ordinarily in the real world might be a competitor. But if you're working in the same industry, you can say, Graham, you host websites, I host websites. People are going to be looking at both of us for business. Why don't we put links to each
other? But I think that's where Google have a problem with it, is that if we do a business arrangement, to link to each other, then that doesn't tell Google anything useful about the relevance of the site. Whereas if I link to you without asking for a link in return, that's because I think your site is relevant, so that score is much higher than an exchange of links.
Interesting. There's certainly a firmly entrenched practice there where people do have, they used to have link farms, but it's not really that obvious or that blatant anymore, is it? But you still do have organisations that do have like link exchange programs, don't you?
One of the things that always stuck in my mind with when we had Adam Lasnik on the phone on the show was about the fact that if you make your site human friendly, it's going to be good for Google, and I think that's really the underlying.
And a big part of that is clarifying what type of content any particular item is.
Mm. So getting back to the blogs, it seems like we're going to have a bit of a fine line, and I think education for a lot of readers, you want to know whether you're reading a blog or whether you're reading a news article before you go
and take anything for gospel. Like, you look at our show here, you know, to make something a bit more magazine-ish, as we would say, a colour piece, you tend to run a piece of music underneath it. It sort of takes the seriousness away from it, for want of a better word. You know, we do that a lot with our stories. They're like magazine articles. That's how you do it in radio. And, of course, when it comes to blogs, blogs need that same sort of undertone, and that happens in its writing, the way people write those blogs and things like that. You've written a lot of blogs, or a lot of pieces in your time, haven't you, Dr.
Yeah, I was thinking before about the forum posting that I did 12 months ago when I was building the media centre at home.
It was fairly similar in tone to Adam's piece.
Well, it was. It had a lot of personal opinion in there, a lot of criticisms about things I didn't like that Microsoft was doing. But
now, you didn't go to any of the manufacturers of the equipment that you used to ask for their balancing opinion, did you?
I certainly didn't. No, I did not. And I wouldn't. I would be horrified if I thought that somebody thought that that post was newsworthy or that it was a news headline. And if I,
because it's opinion.
Exactly right, Gray. And if I opened up a newspaper the next day and saw, Tech Talk Radio says that, you know, Microsoft has failed delivering, you know, media center or something, I would have been absolutely horrified. It's not what I was aiming to do.
So did the big bad internet do an evil thing and make a good journalist, Adam, write a bad piece?
No, not at all.
No. No, he hasn't written a bad piece. He's written a very, very good piece.
He's written an informative piece which would be invaluable to anyone who was setting up a home, you know, media center on Vista.
But Adam would never have written something like that if it wasn't for the internet and wasn't for the nature of blogging as we've come to know it.
Yes, he would.
Yeah,
because traditionally, when you haven't had an internet, these sorts of things are covered off in editorials and opinion columns in newspapers and such things.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, deathly silence. I'm sitting here hitting send and receive on the laptop here because Adam's emailing us at the same time.
No, there you go.
if you have a factual news item or if you have an opinion, then send it through to us at feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
That'd be good. Now, we're going to move on. We're going to have a break. And after the break, we're going to return about and talk about upgrading your computers, some nightmarish stories that we've sort of had over the course of time, whether you choose to blog them and tell other people about them, or you can come and vent your spleen here on the forum at techtalkradio.com.au. Any of those places. And we're also going to be joined by Sarah Bond from Microsoft Australia. She's involved in the Office 2007 rollout.
Excellent. They've made a lot of changes in the new Office suite, so I'm looking forward to hearing from Sarah.
Absolutely. It's something we're all going to have to come to grips with fairly soon.
All this XML stuff, have you got to
like it or not? In the industry we work in, yes.
Have you managed to receive a DOCX? Is it X?
Yeah, I think it is.
DOCX file format.
No.
Because that's the new XML. If you get one of those, you need the convertery thing if you want to open it in 2003.
Everything will be explained. Yeah.
Back with more after this.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work.
Poor Charlie. The relative, can't in Charlie's pee.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
It's funny, actually, the discussion about blogging continued out in the kitchen before while we were all getting our drinks and things like that, so...
And with just as much passion as it was on air.
It was indeed. But anyway, we're going to change the subject now. But if you want to contribute, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. Have you ever done an upgrade to a machine? Have you ever contemplated doing an upgrade to a machine? Have you ever laid in bed at night and lost sleep about doing an upgrade to a machine? Well,
have I ever had to check myself into therapy because I upgraded a machine?
That's right. Yes. If you have, you're not alone.
Yes to all of the above, yeah.
It's a big decision, which is a lot of people face in the course of being a computer person across any genre of machines, whether it be Linux, whether it be Mac, whether it be PC or whatever, at some stage in your life, you're going to have to do an upgrade. Now, can I tell you the ones that I dread? I dread the iTunes upgrade. I go, oh no,
the
Apple
new version of
iTunes. Because I've got a lot of music on my machine, and literally I have to let it sit there and do its thing for, I'm not kidding, 4, 5, 6 hours while it goes through and indexes all the songs and stuff that I use.
And, and if it all goes wrong, you've lost quite a considerable resource there for your...
Well, there's a lot of time and effort that goes back into it. And that's what I said in the introduction of the show tonight. Like, it's not just the pain and suffering financially of buying new software. It's the physical and mental stress and...
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, how many times have you started a... Or, you know, done an installation and it gets three quarters of the way through and says... installation cannot continue because of an unknown error. Like, we've all had those before, haven't
absolutely,
we?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what do you do? You're in the business, Graham. What do you do when you get the unknown... Do you just, like...
You Google the error message.
If it's an unknown error, you can't Google that. It'll... No, you can try it if you like. There'll be millions of the damn things come up, I'm sure. But, operating systems are also an interesting one. But...
we've been in positions before, I'm sure, myself and Graham, probably you as well, Andrew, where professionally we've had to upgrade a system, and we're not just upgrading software, we're changing operating systems, we're changing the actual chassis or the computer system that the customer owns and that's running. We're changing software, we're doing a huge, it really is a huge task, and all for the sake of preserving customers' data.
You
might be interstate, you might have a very tight timeline, you might have flights to catch and things like that, you might have other customers that you have to go to.
And apart from anything else, your customer's got a business to run, and it's got to be up and running on 9 o'clock Monday morning.
That's the key to it, isn't it?
And then you're putting yourself under a lot of pressure to actually get this thing working.
I've been pressured by my accountant at the end of this financial year to upgrade my version of QuickBooks that I use for my business. And I'm going, hey, it ain't broke. I'm not going to fix it. And he goes, yes, you are. And I'm sort of thinking,
but it is broken because the tax rules are wrong or something like that, is it?
It does my best perfectly each and every quarter. Okay. And I can lodge it and the tax office, Mr.
So why is your
Costello
accountant pressuring you to upgrade?
Well, because it's the 2000... this is the version that came out when we had the GST come out in 2001, wasn't it? I think in Australia where we got...
2000, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of versions flying under the bridge. I just don't think you can open it, just be quiet.
Oh, I see, yes. So that's another good reason to upgrade, is to be compatible with other people you need to share information with.
Yeah, so I'm dreading that one. But
on the other side of the coin, though, there are people that put off upgrading, like you were saying, Andrew, because if it's not broke, don't fix it. But then there are other people who say, as a new version, have to upgrade. And they don't offer any valid reason as to why they should be upgrading, other than there is a new version available.
Yeah, and sometimes there are good reasons, like there's security issues that need to be addressed, and sometimes there are less good reasons.
One of the tips I'll pass on to people is, rule number one in my rule of upgrading is never, ever delete or overwrite a particular piece of software if you have to. For example, if you're going to upgrade a hard drive or you want to do an install of, let's say you're going from Windows 2000 to Windows XP or something like that, hard drives are very cheap these days. Have you noticed? They're, you know, $100 or so. And
so you're talking about hardware upgrade upgrade.
Keep your drive, take your old drive out of the machine, put a new drive in, you get the advantage of a fresh installation along the line. You should have your old CD there so you can prove to the Microsoft or the updating software that, yes, you do own a legitimate copy, and go and it just installs a fresh version
for
you.
Yeah, this is a valid point. Whether that's the way you do it or by some other method, always have an ability to roll back and a fallback position in case things go wrong.
Oh, yes.
And if it's a mission-critical system, especially if you're running your business or you're running your blog or whatever that's important to you off this machine, make sure you've got backups and take it offline and do the upgrade so that you've got a position to go back to if it all goes wrong.
Graham's right. If the worst of the worst happens and disaster after disaster follows and nothing goes right, at least you should
happened
be back.
Before.
Exactly. At least you should be back at the position you were when you started and nothing's been lost. You haven't gone backwards as such. You've just wasted some time.
Yeah. So step one, clone the drive, get a copy of Norton Ghost or something similar. Step two, upgrade the copy.
Yeah, getting Ghost and things like that is a bit tricky for some people.
Sometimes, it's one way to tackle the problem. Yeah. Sometimes you might just want to do a complete backup using NT Backup if it's a Windows XP system.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I use NT Backup every night to back up my servers where my client's information is, because obviously the guys at the office, we update the server daily, and you need a backup on a different drive, different machine, different everywhere. So
And NT Backup has come a long way in its history.
It has. Now, who backs up their own personal stuff? Like, I do it personally, as in business-wise, I back my stuff up. But who, when it comes to photos of the kids, that like who hasn't got a digital camera these days, and you want to, you know, you keep it all in your hard drive, because where else do you keep photos these days? Like, I can fill DVDs of 2 megabit, you know, photos and stuff of the kids. Do you back it up?
I do. Well, I think one of the smart things that Microsoft did a few years ago was introduce the My Documents type folder structure. We used to have operating systems where people would put stuff wherever and whenever they wanted. And
they still do.
Well, they do to an extent, and you have customer data spread all over a hard disk. But these days, my recommendation to people is if you keep all your documents and your photos, Andrew, your spreadsheets, everything, somewhere in that My Documents structure, if you're a user of Windows, the Windows operating system, it's very easy just to say, copy the My Documents folder, and all of your data is secure then. It's backed up.
Yep, absolutely.
Now, one of the other big things these days is moving from one major release to another of a piece of operating system, whether it be Adobe, whether it be Microsoft, or whatever.
I'm just getting heart palpitations thinking about this.
You are. Just at work recently, we've migrated for doing all the web stuff from Dreamweaver 8 right through to the new Dreamweaver. Well, it's gone from Macromedia to Adobe now, so there were major changes rolled out in that. But you look at Microsoft. Microsoft have rolled out Office 2007. Now,
isn't that a big change?
That's the thing. It's probably the biggest change that you've seen in the Office suite ever. Like, I can still name people that are using Office 97 and say, I can still spell check and I can still do my word processing and it still works.
And since Office 97 to Office 2003, the basic look and feel hasn't changed.
Exactly.
Document formats haven't radically changed.
Yeah, well, we used to
have... Well, not since Word 6 has the Word document changed.
Word 6, yeah. We have binary document files. Now, the binary document files are, you know, nothing you can open up and read in a plain text editor or anything like that. It's all like computer gobbledygook inside of it.
It's a proprietary format that Microsoft uses.
And now we're moving into this new domain of XML, which is a format where we have basically plain English in it. It's like having sections in a file. There's a bit there for the pictures, a bit there for the text, a bit there for formatting.
Well, like a web page, it's plain text instructions on how to build the Word document.
And all the manufacturers are heading that way, which is great for interoperability across platforms, across absolutely everything.
Except that, they're not quite heading all in the same direction, are they?
There's a few variations of a theme, but I think they'll iron themselves out in the course of time. And this week, I was lucky to catch up with Sarah Bond. Now, Sarah works for Microsoft. She is the strategy manager for Microsoft Australia and responsible for promoting platform initiatives across the business groups within Microsoft. And she gets feedback from customers and partners alike and gives it back to the groups that are actually developing the software.
Oh, very good.
She's been there for almost 5 years, including 9 months in her current role. And she's specialised in SQL Server products and things like that, so she knows a bit about how business works. The thing that is pretty amazing, this is a test of character, I reckon, is that Sarah also spent 8 years in the Australian Army Signals Corp, including an exchange with the British Army. Maybe
well,
that's
what
gets you instead for working for a large corporation like Microsoft, where you just have to be on your guard, I suppose. But anyway, nonetheless, I caught up with Sarah during the course of this week, and we talked all about what Office 2007 can do, and the rollout, and how easy it is to do the upgrade.
And the new file formats?
Yes, the new file format. I wish I could speak. The new file formats as well. Sarah, it's been 4 years or so since Microsoft updated the world's most popular Office suite. Apart from the aesthetic changes, what are the main differences between Office 2003 and Office 2007?
In that time, our biggest focus was on considering how people use their applications, such as Word, processing, spreadsheets, and PowerPoint presentations. And if you think about the number of releases that came out since, you know, even before 2000, we'd added hundreds and hundreds of features, but it was, I guess, groaning into a pretty extensive menu system. So sometimes we get strong feedback from our hundreds of users saying, you know, it's difficult to find the command that I need to do the job I have at hand. So we really focused on making that a lot easier. So, if you know, the first thing that someone will notice when they open up one of the Office applications is the ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
And this provides kind of context-sensitive menu structures. So if someone's editing a graph or a table and they want to format that, usually it's become so much easier to find the tools to do that. do it in a really easy way, and much more centric to the way people, you know, prefer to use the tools and do work than having to delve deep into a menu structure trying to find the right command to do that. And then there's a whole lot of smarts that that are hidden to the user around the document format. And some really key things is around the size of the documents when they're saved. So, you know, we can, with this new new Office 2007, you can see sometimes 50 to 75% reduction in the size of the document when it's saved. And if you're like me and you've got hundreds and hundreds of documents and you've got, you know, it's external hard drive and you're saving and you're backing up, that becomes a really great thing just in how you maintain your documents into the future. But also if you want to send them to, you know, someone who may not have as fast a broadband or internet access as you do, you know, the file size is so much smaller so they can get that in a quicker time frame.
Okay, most Office users are used to the binary files, that is the traditional .doc and .xls and PPT files, etc. If you were to open them in a text file reader, they'd look like a collection of recognisable gobbledygook and in no particular order. So what's the main difference now with the new file structure? Because apparently you can, open it in a text editor and do changes if you wanted to, which means it's great news for people trying to rescue files that may have been damaged in transit, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So it's an open standard, so the way that that documents are saved now can be reviewed by, obviously, an Office application, but a text editor like you've described. It's also really powerful in regards to the way that information is stored, so it's described. There's some things that are described in the way the document is saved. So imagine if you're writing a report and you've got a date and you've got a heading. In the past, those things would be stored in exactly the same way as a line of text would be. But now the way the new formats is it actually describes those things separately. And a user doesn't see this, but when they save the document, the smarts are there in the document format to do that. So, you know, in the future when they're trying to search on remembering a document that they saved and they knew some of the content that was inside it, they may have new, you know, names or dates, then, you know, they can use search engines, they can use other third-party applications that, you know, can read XML. And to get access to that information. So that's a pretty key thing.
You've sort of answered my next question, actually, which is why the move away from what everyone's used to the new XML file format?
So there's some benefits. You've already touched on one benefit, which was, you know, being able to recover files. So, you know, we've all felt the pain where we've been working on a document or a report and, you know, it's the 11th hour and we're about to save it and we're changing the formatting and we're changing the tables and adding pictures. We save it. We go away to have that cup of coffee, come back to open up again and the file's corrupted and we can't get access to it. And there's generally two options that people have had, which is, you know, call in an expert to help them recover that file or to completely, you know, start from scratch again to write that report.
I think it's more the latter really in some instances, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Depends if you're like me and you do things, you're still editing, you know, right up to the wire. And now the way with this document format, with Office 2007, it's the smarts are there so that only the thing that's corrupt within the file. So for example, if you had that report and it was an image that you pasted in and that image is corrupted, well, that's the only thing that you lose. The rest of the content and the things that you've added to that report are recoverable. So that's a great thing.
All right, well, we're talking about XML file formats, but Microsoft has introduced OOXML or Open Office XML file formats. What's the difference?
The Office Open XML format is for document format. So, you know, XML is a language that generally is used in lots of different contexts. But Office Open XML is particularly for Office word processing, spreadsheets, and presentations.
All right, and you mentioned earlier that the OOXML files, or what are they going to be now? They'll be .x, isn't it?
Yeah,
is that a new file extension?
.x, that's right.
Okay, and they're going to be smaller in all product ranges right across the board? Is that the plan?
OpenXML is the document format for Microsoft Word, Spread Excel, and PowerPoint. But the great thing about it is that it is an open standard, so other organisations can also build their applications to support the same format. So, you know, I guess the first thing about that is if someone, you know, is using Microsoft Office and they have a friend that they're sending a document to that's using a different application, if they both use the same document format, then it's easy for them both to read that document.
Well, let's talk about backward compatibility, because this is always the big question when people are moving forward is, can I use my old XML file, sorry, or my old document files and my own spreadsheet files in the new system? Obviously, the answer is yes, but I suspect that once you migrate to the new format, you can't go backwards?
No, that's not true. When, the advanced saving capabilities, Office 2007, is when you do save your document in Office 2007, you have the option of saving it as Office 2003 or Office 2000, or in a way that can be read by an older application. And for those people who, you know, don't have Office 2007, so these things are, you know, it can be used, and you know, anyone who's using Office 2007 has the full access to those things. But if someone isn't using Office 2007 and you want to send them a document, you can save that as an Office 2003 or Office 2000, or somebody can download a compatibility pack from the web, which is a free download, and they can get access to those files and read them and edit them just as anyone using Office 2007 would.
If you're a home user, or even if you're a business user, how will the transition to XML files affect existing Office users?
Anyone who's an existing Office user who uses Office 2007 will be able to open up those old documents without any problem.
So it's seamless, really. No one, yes. You wouldn't know the difference.
That's right. And I guess the immediate benefit is, you know, once you open it up and you save it as in the new document format, you get the reduction in the size of the document. You also, there's some security benefits as well. One of the issues of, you know, when you send documents to in an organization to other your peers or outside your organization, sometimes things like track changes and comments and editing comments and personal information would be retained in those documents. With Office 2007, it will strip that away before you send it. So, you know, that's another key benefit that they'll get as soon as they migrate to Office 2007.
All right, well, while we're talking about security, talk to me about macros. What does this mean to software functionality for those? I'm not sure how many people would use macros, but obviously there's a few out there.
There's definitely some power users. I don't really think anyone who's using those macros is a power user of Office, as we like to call them. There is macro support inside of 2007. There's always testing. You know, they have to test it in the new version, but the capability around coding, I guess, is extended. If you are a power user and you build macros, you'll have even more capability with Office 2007.
Independent software vendors can write macros and applications in .NET, and, of course, Visual Basic to hook into Office, you know, collaborative data objects, which is probably on the back burner these days. How will the new Office suite be able to use those sort of functions? Or will those vendors be able to have plugins that just work off the shelf?
Office OpenXML is an open standard, so it's a fully described document standard that any, you know, independent software vendor can, you know, go deeper, develop more, get more value out of than ever before. So it's a really good thing. In fact, we have people like Novell are already supporting using OpenXML as a document format, Coral for WordPerfect. So, you know, it's goodness for third party.
So all the manufacturers are going down the OpenXML format.
There is absolutely wide use of it.
Does the transition to XML affect Office products in different ways? Obviously, you know, what would traditionally be a database, what would traditionally be a spreadsheet. Is there any sort of side effects by migrating the whole suite across to OpenXML?
From transitioning and bringing in documents into OpenXML, where you retain the look and feel, you retain the information that was in it, the presentation. What you obviously have is the ability to use Office 2007 to extend that. The good thing is also that because the document format, OpenXML, is consistent, the document format with Microsoft Word, with Microsoft PowerPoint and Microsoft Excel, if you're using information and passing documents between those applications, you actually retain that information and don't lose any sort of capability in moving between those three different applications.
The new file format also changes the way that Office users are going to work with applications that they use in their daily tasks. Can you give any examples across the different ranges of applications?
There's one as an example of, the integration capabilities. There's an application called MindJet, which is used for mind mapping. So when teams brainstorm and they want to map out the ideas and the actions that they, you know, that they undertake with those ideas. It's a third party. It is a partner of Microsoft. But when that mind mapping work is done on that software tool, they'll save it. They can save it as a OpenXML document format. And then someone who's using Office but doesn't have access to that MindJet application can still read that file inside of Office, can edit it, can review it, can save it.
And then those users of MindJet can then open it and still, you know, retain the information, and they understand what it's about, and, you know, they can work together without having the same application, which is a great thing for usability.
All right, when we talk about Microsoft, we generally have PCs in mind. Are there any noticeable differences with the product on the Mac platform or any other platforms for that matter?
The Mac community of developers have used OpenXML to do translations between the Mac-centric type document formats and applications and Microsoft Office. So it's really up to the software vendor who's developing it to make it fly.
And most businesses, and individuals for that matter, work on the principle that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So how long will it take users to change their way of thinking and get on board with the new OpenOffice XML formats?
We have some feedback on, you know, the first, it's a shock when someone opens Office 2007 and sees the new user interface. And then it's delight, you know, particularly around creating reports and having some great editing and presentation kind of tool sets at their fingertips and in a way that's really easy to use. So once those, you know, that first, you know, foray into building a report or, you know, analyzing data using Excel is undertaken, I think it'll be rapid, because it is a dramatic improvement in just how easy it is to use and produce quality reports and quality documents.
About 12 months ago, there was a bit of a battle between Adobe and Microsoft with the PDF feature, PDF obviously becoming very, very popular in the business world to save and email files around. Is there any news in that sector about what if there's going to be support for PDF in future releases?
The Office has some support for PDF today. You can save files as a PDF. So, you know, as an industry, Microsoft and Adobe and other developers of similar productivity suites, we work together to ensure that there's, you know, compatibility and interoperability between the different applications. You know, I think that effort will continue.
Sarah, can you tell me a little bit about the preservation of documents?
Because of the new document format that's supported inside of Microsoft Office 2007, when someone has saved their document today, they can feel confident that in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time, if that document is, you know, they're stored somewhere, they'll be able to get access to that. You know, the good thing, they won't have to have the application that they used the year that they created that document. Any XML reader or document application in the future will be able to read that.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
So, Dr. Ronnie, are you regretting that you actually took Office 2007 off your machine now? You're wishing you stuck with it there?
The version that I put on my machine was a beta version, that's right, and that was probably coming up to 12 months ago now, so I'll have to look at upgrading. I don't know what my current Office version is, I'm sorry to say, because I haven't used my Windows machine to edit Word documents for a long time.
How can you do current opinion pieces on this radio program if you don't actually have something there that you can talk about, like Office and PCs and things like that?
Well, I've been using OpenOffice on the Linux machine, which is altogether completely different.
Is that XML-based yet?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And how does that work? Like, we're talking about, there's been a lot of face-pulling and gurning in the studio here this evening in relation to OOXML. Now, XML stands for
Extensible Markup Language,
which is a version of HTML, if you drop the X and put HT in the front of it there, all that sort of stuff. But this is OOXML. Now, why were you guys going a bit funny about the OpenOffice XML?
Well, Dr. Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, but with OpenOffice.org, it can save word processing documents in an XML format, but it's not the OOXML format that Microsoft uses. It's a different XML format.
That's right. Microsoft have devised their own structure for what they call Office Open XML, OOXML. So it's not exactly the same.
So why do we have two different open standards? If there's already an open standard, why did the other one have to come into existence? I'm not sure which one came first.
Could XML not handle some of the formatting issues and containment of JPEGs and things like that? Is that why?
Well, no, the definition of XML is that you can introduce or create your own tags and your own fields within the file, and it can accommodate whatever you want it
to. Yeah, that's for XML generally.
That's right.
But for the Office, there's two different formats for Office documents in XML format. There's the OOXML and there's the which Microsoft use, and there's whatever OpenOffice.org's XML format is.
Which seems to be
different again.
That's right. Seems to be more of a standard.
XML is used for a lot of other things apart from document forms.
Yeah, like
for
podcasting example, feeds.
Podcasting feeds, RSS feeds, news feeds, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, even Google Earth now will bring an XML feed in. Absolutely. Like that, so.
You might have created a sitemap for your website.
Yeah, sitemap.xml, yeah, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing, which the questions which open up in this too, is if we've gone into plain text, so to speak, in our XML formats, that means that if Google links to a document or a spreadsheet or something online, rather than hitting that wall of computerese binary file, which it probably doesn't know what to make of it, now, Ken, does that mean we're going to have better indexing?
I would imagine it would.
Doc files, even the desktop Google search might also make life a bit easier too, because you could search within a document, couldn't
well,
you?
Well, I don't know whether it does yet, but it certainly could in the future, because whereas even historically we've had for a while being able to search for a word inside a document, so you can search for documents containing TikTok radio.
If you think of that in an office environment, that would be like if you're a large organisation, I saw an office document, or I saw a document which had these words in it the other day. Let me search that folder.
Well, you've always been able to do that for quite a while now. But what this will allow will be for that search to be even smarter, and not only to search for a particular word, but a particular word in a certain place in the document. So you might remember that the word Tech Talk Radio occurred in the in a header, or in a chapter title, or in a footnote. And you'll be able to search
for a footnote which contains.
Now, I don't know of any technology that does this yet, but because of the nature of the XML format that contains all this information in an easily readable way, it should be quite easy to implement.
I was concerned about backward compatibility with the new version of Office, but I'm pleased to see that Microsoft is offering a plugin for users of Microsoft Office 2000, the XP in 2003 and such things. You can go to their website, you can download a compatibility pack.
Oh, so you can open up the new document formats with the old versions of Office.
That's right.
Presumably with some of the new features missing.
That's right. But if somebody sends you a .docx file,
which is bound to happen very shortly, you haven't got it already,
and you think, what the hell am I going to do with this? You can download the compatibility pack and you can open it.
And is that something that you have to pay for, or is that just downloadable as an Office update?
My answer is I don't know, but I believe that it would be just downloadable.
That'll be one to look up. The other thing that Microsoft do is, and they've done it, I presume they've done it for Office 2007 as well, because they have in the past for other Office versions, is they often have free viewers for these Office formats. So even if you don't have Word and somebody is sending you Word documents, you can get a Word viewer that allows you to view the document even if you can't edit it.
That sort of comes freely installed on a lot of machines, isn't it? Were they called
sometimes
Microsoft Works or something?
No. This is different to Works. This is
what's Works?
Microsoft's
I've seen
Word
it, but I don't
viewer.
Use it. Is it like a cut-down student package or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Time ago, galaxy far, far away. Haven't seen Works for ages.
I'll uninstall it then. It's on my laptop, and I bought it the other day.
Is it really?
There you go.
All right. Now, just before we go to the next break, Microsoft changed their Vista search. Now, you mentioned this in the news before too, Graham.
Yeah.
Do you know what this is about? Apparently, Microsoft fended off Google's antitrust complaints by agreeing to make it easier for users to choose a competitor's search program.
Well, I have to admit that even after having read that in the news, I'm still not 100% clear on what they've changed. But the complaint was that Vista comes with a desktop search.
The normal search that you see on XP and all that too.
Well, only better, because if you remember, that search that was in Windows XP and has been in all the older Windows versions back to about Windows 95 to search your hard drive for a document of a particular name or something like that, there's a much... If you've ever installed the Google desktop search, you'll notice that the Google one works like that, whereas
instantly.
The Microsoft one that came with Windows used to take forever to grind through the whole disk because it didn't do any indexing. When it needed to find something, it had to go and look for it.
It was quicker the second time round once it had indexed things, but it was pretty ordinary the first time round.
Whereas the Google one does the indexing up front. Now, Microsoft have included their own equivalent of that that does proper full indexing in Windows Vista, but they didn't originally include a way for you to swap that out for, say, Google's one if you happen to prefer Google's one. Or for other ones.
But now you can, or they've
well,
made it so.
Well, I think they've made it so that you can have the two of them side by side. From what I've read, you can't turn the Microsoft one off. So if you do install the Google one as well, you end up with them both running side by side and both doing their indexing, which is going to be a bit of a problem because you're going to get two lots of indexes. Yeah, exactly right. But at least they put support in there for it, so you can install it if you want it.
Very good. All right, feedback, techtalkradio.com.au, or come and talk to us on the Tech Talk Radio forum forum.techtalkradio.com.au if you have anything to add, because no doubt this is not going to go away in a short term, because this is big stuff.
But thanks very much to Sarah Bond for agreeing to talk to us on the program.
Oh, absolutely. And we're all going to be using Office 2007 in the future.
We are. And despite the technical things that we are some of the things we're complaining about, it is good to see that Microsoft is heading towards an open standard rather than having proprietary binary file format. So well done.
And one thing I'd also like to say before I lose my voice is that it was good to see that Microsoft were actually willing to come on the radio and talk about it. A lot of these organisations tend to hide behind closed doors, but good on you, Microsoft, for coming out and having a chat. It's not the first time we've had them on the show, and hopefully we'll have some more down the track. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my own!
Have you ever had issues with DVDs that you've purchased on eBay, Andrew or Graham?
Never bought a DVD on eBay.
Or maybe from overseas where you've got region problems.
No.
I didn't know how to get around those. I've got a region-free DVD player. Just place them.
Well, this is a region-free DVD player. This
free
is,
for free.
It is free for free. This was contributed by Jeff Gates. So, g'day, Jeff, and thanks for the
back from holidays.
Contribution. G'day, yes, welcome back. He's been tripping around Europe. My latest gadget, and one that might be interesting to listeners, is the Pioneer DVD.
He was going to come to Australia, but he didn't.
Yeah, he was going to come out here, wasn't he?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. That's all right. Jeff. Come on, lift.
The Pioneer DV490V. So, we've had the Pioneer guys on the show before as well. This is a new DVD player, which is marketed as regionless. He's bought his with HDMI output, which is the new high definition multimedia interface. Jeff says, I hooked it up to the plasma and popped in a PAL DVD from the UK. Of course, he wouldn't have PAL over there. Normally, he'd have NTSC, wouldn't he,
yes,
in the United States?
Never twice the same colour.
That's what it stands for. Bam, it played the disc. Best yet, it played it in native PAL on my flat screen with no conversion. So he's a big fan.
I also liked PAL. Yeah, I'm a big fan of PAL too.
I'm a big fan of PAL.
Especially once you've seen NTSC, I'm a big fan of PAL.
He wanted to get a player that didn't convert discs that he picked up in... He had discs that he picked up in Germany and France with the family a month ago. So there you go, Pioneer DV490. I haven't got a price here, Andrew. That was remiss of me. But
wouldn't be that much these days, in this current genre of all these good things. All right.
Dime a dozen these days. So thanks, Jeff, for that contribution.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
The Tech Talk Radio website of the week this week is a little bit carbon friendly.
Oh.
Have you, there's a website called coco2.org. coco2.org. Now, if your website...
Now, is it something to do with hot chocolate, or...?
No.
Anything to do with the Tandy colour computer?
No. Guess again. It's global warming.
Okay.
Carbon dioxide and the likes. Now, an organisation in the United Kingdom has come to the realisation that websites generate carbon.
How?
And we need to be carbon neutral when it comes to building our websites, because let's face it, people... No, this is not the hotspot. People actually...
You're
looking
at
me really strange here. People need to actually, you know, have their computers on to surf your website, so generating electricity. You've generated electricity writing your website. The server that's on, that's hosting your website, is using electricity, so therefore you're carbon imbalance. And these guys can fix it for the mere sum of £6 per annum.
Something's imbalanced.
£6 per annum is what it's going to cost you to be carbon neutral
I think
on your
unbalanced
website.
Unbalanced is the word you're looking for.
How do they fix it? And how do I...
They plant a tree.
Do they?
This is...
And then they build a website
of
the tree.
Come on, you heathens. This is why it's the website of the week. Go and read it. You can find it. All the information is there. You can use WorldPay to pay and all that sort of stuff. But, yes, it's how to be carbon neutral when it comes to websites.
What's the address again, Andrew?
Coco, baby. Coco2.org. W's in front of it, if you please, but...
coco2.org.
If anything else, it makes you feel as if you've done your bit for keeping the carbon in the ground and maybe emptying your pocket a little bit more. £6, what's that, about $13?
But ironically, they've got a website about it.
Yeah, we won't go on. All right, yes, thank you very much. Coco2.org is Tech Talk Radio's website of the week.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Sure. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
A convicted double murderer in Texas is holding a joke contest on the internet so he can use the winning entry as his last words when he dies by lethal injection this week.
Oh, where do you get these from?
Patrick Knight, 39,
yeah,
told,
I got my cocos.
Told CNN in an interview from his prison last week, "Death is my punishment. I've accepted that, but if you've got to go, go with a smile." He's going to be enjoying his last days on Earth. "I'm asking you to spread the word that I'm holding a contest. I want people to send me their best jokes to keep me and the others with execution dates laughing." Knight has promised to read the winning entry out loud when he's asked for his last statements before he is put to death later this week. And on that cheery note, there's our odd spot.
Graham and I are speechless, really? Okay, good. Where do you send your emails for the joke, by the way?
Well, I deliberately didn't announce that, but I'm sad to say that news.yahoo.com did actually put a link to his website. It's a MySpace site.
Oh,
there, so you can go digging and find it if you like and make a contribution to Coco at the same time. And yes.
Good.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Dr. Ron. That was his contribution over there. Graham Callaghan and myself, Andrew McComb. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. Thank you to everybody who contributes to this show, including Lydia Davis and, of course, Adam.
Thank you to Sarah.
Adam Turner will be joining us in the studio sometime fairly shortly too.
Good, good.
So we'll be able to have a chat to him live. And yes, thanks to Sarah.
Sarah Bond
from Microsoft. She joined us this evening. So stay tuned. This show always unfolds normally about Saturday afternoon. So who knows what will be on next week's show. But thank you, boys. Mark will be in next week, I believe. We can talk about the demise of CDMA. Well, and maybe not, but other things. So
iPod listeners, we know you're people too. Well, hang in there.
All right, yes. Hopefully you'll get show 26 in the not too distant future. Until next week, it's bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.